Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, we're going to have a continuation of our conversations with remarkable minds. Dr. Elizabeth Sartoris. She'll be talking with us on Skype from Mallorca, Spain, and she is an evolutionary biologist and a philosopher, futurist, and a former professor specializing in the designs of living systems. Professor from MIT, University of Massachusetts, she is quite simply one of the more unique people on this planet. I'm going to do a newsmaker update with her on what she believes are the consequences globally of having corporations such as Monsanto have the power to design our seeds, patent the life forms, and then control what we eat. Also today, a commentary, Sweatshops on Wheels, from Chris Hedges from Tutig. We're going to look at the environment because there's new information that is suggesting that we no longer are in a place to predict the outcomes. Summer ice melt on Antarctica is now non-linear, fastest in over 1,000 years. I'll give you the latest from Nature Geoscience. Agricultural chemicals blamed for chronic disease in Sri Lanka. And how many people are affected? In just this one area, over 500,000. The top five similarities and practices between big tobacco and big pharma. Also today, will Monsanto's ties influence nutritionist stance on GMOs? This is really important, and I'll explain why. Of course, the latest on health and healing from our public health segment, a new research that confirms what we have been talking about recently, aluminum in vaccines as adjuvants and neurological disorders. This is important, so I'll share that with you. As you see, we have a packed show. Let's begin. Always important to have wonderful soft sounds before we go to sleep at night. It's also good when we use them during our meditations, prayers, chants, as a source of relaxing ourselves. But there's also something that can happen. This is from the peer-reviewed journal Neuron, and it says the following. Sounds can help strengthen your memory during sleep. Sounds that are in sync with the brain's slow oscillations help enhance memory. Slow oscillations, by the way, in the brain occur during your slow wave sleep and are associated with memory. The sound stimulations can also help you sleep better. Quote, the beauty lies in the simplicity to apply auditory stimulation at low intensities, an approach that is both practical and ethical. If compared with, for example, with electrical stimulation and therefore portrays a straightforward tool for clinical settings to enhance sleep rhythms, end quote. That's the lead author of the study. The researchers found that when participants were exposed to sounds that synchronized with the brain's slow oscillation rhythm, they were better at remembering the word associations than when they were exposed to sounds that were not in sync. Now, what does this mean in just regular lay discussion? It means this. Have you ever heard a mother singing a lullaby and the baby goes to sleep? If she were screaming lyrics from a, you know, strong, loud sound or singing opera, would not go to sleep. Have you ever been in one of those special places? I have it at my home where I have 10 roofs. And the reason I put 10 on the roof is because I love how it sounds when water hits it in the rain. In the summertime, it rains every day in the late afternoon. And for people who are stressed, you just go there and you sit and the rain hits and suddenly you are deep into sleep. That is a synchronized oscillation. or something like water running, the tapes of water running over rocks, or a rainstorm on a CD, or chimes, or a flute, or a harp. Now, if you put one of those on and you're trying to sleep, it's going to facilitate getting to sleep. It's going to allow you to have a deeper sleep, and it'll allow you to remember more when you wake up. So that's what's important. Versus having radio on in the background that doesn't oscillate. I'm going to do a little deeper on vitamin C today, a mini classroom on the air, because right now there are about 35,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature on vitamin C. When you have tens of thousands of studies, you have hundreds of millions of patients' experiences at the clinical level, and then you still have people questioning, should they take vitamin C? Or if they eat an orange, don't they get their vitamin C? Well, yes, you could get your vitamin C from eating an orange, just enough to prevent scurvy. But you'd have to eat an orchard in order to get what you need if you have cancer, if you have a defective immune system, or if you want to slow down the aging process. Just before coming on the air today, I went up to the store to get a glass of juice. And as I was walking out of the store, someone who I've known who lives and works on the Upper West Side for many, many years, many decades, where I have been my entire time in New York, because I really enjoy the neighborhood and the people and the aesthetics of being able to go to Riverside Park or Central Park to walk anywhere, to walk uptown, downtown. It's just ideal for me. And here was this person who at one time came to see me, and I said, how healthy do you want to be? And the person said, well, not too healthy. And I said, well, okay, then you tell me what you want to achieve, and I'll see if I can't create something that helps you. The person set the bar so low that I only had to spend maybe an hour explaining what was needed. Now when this person comes up, I notice the face is very bloated, puffy. And the person said, yeah. So I couldn't do it naturally, so I got cosmetic surgery. And I didn't say anything. I said, well, as long as you're happy with it, that's what's important. And the person says, well, I'm happy with how I look, because I look 20 years younger, she says, but I'm not happy about how I feel. And then she started reading a whole litany of problems. High blood pressure, diabetes, metabolic syndrome imbalance, arthritis in the knees and the fingers, disjointed fingers, memory loss. Now, the person is 64 years of age. And then said, well, what should I do? And I said again, do you remember what you asked me 20 years ago? And I said, how healthy do you want to be? And you said, not much, because you realized you weren't going to stop drinking coffee. You weren't going to stop eating the processed foods. So I ask you the question again today. How healthy do you want to be? And she said, I have to answer the same way. My disposition, my social schedule, I just don't want to change anything. Is there a pill I can take that would help me if I don't change? Yeah, cyanide. Nothing else is going to change you. If you think you're going to get younger and your skin is going to get younger and your eyes are going to look better and your breath is going to be sweeter and your gums are going to be tighter and your teeth are going to be tighter and you're going to be mineralized and your heart's going to be at a lower pulse rate and your arteries clear and the tumor's killed, you have to work on it. And if you take a shortcut, you will pay a price. Well, vitamin C is the one universal nutrient above and beyond all other nutrients that can make a difference, even when it's not at high doses. I believe that if people were actually taking vitamin C based upon how much they individually require, they'd be taking about 10 to 30,000 milligrams a day. I've seen what has happened when people have hepatitis, AIDS-defining illnesses, herpes, cancers. I've seen in thousands and thousands and thousands of patients at the Tri-State Healing Center, and in my own counseling, that when you start giving intravenous vitamin C, you do more to interfere in the disease process and enhance the healing process than any other single therapy on the planet, current or historical. So when I read an article that is still questioning, you know, should we take 100 milligrams of vitamin C? Yeah, if you're a cockroach in good health and not eating Wonder Bread, I guess you could get by. But in reality, we need a lot more vitamin C. We should have it in buffered form. I want to share something from the latest Life Extension. Here's what it says, and this is very accurate, to give you an idea of why we should be using vitamin C and what it does at the cellular level in enhancing our survival from just a few conditions. I'll quote this. In a human clinical study, vitamin C supplements were superior to other therapies at increasing concentration levels. The results are important because of the exposures environmental toxins were exposed to. Then it goes on to say, with heart disease, and this is important, quote, oxidative damage, by the way, that's meaning normal living, breathing, that's where you get your oxygen, plays a central role in developing heart disease and strokes, as oxidative density lipoproteins, or the LDL, accumulate and trigger inflammation reactions within blood vessel walls. Oxidation impairs endothelial function, the measure of blood vessels' ability to regulate blood flow and pressure, potentially starving vital tissue, such as the hard-working heart muscle, of their essential blood supply. Aging and chronic diseases, such as diabetes, bring in ever more oxidation and loss of normal blood vessel function. Epidemiological studies demonstrate that people with the highest blood levels and daily intake of vitamin C are at as much as 50% reduced risk of developing or dying from cardiovascular disease. Men with the lowest blood levels of vitamin C have a 240% greater risk of having a stroke compared to those having the highest levels of vitamin C. That risk is enhanced in men who have additional risk factors such as being overweight or hypertensive, and the risk of having high blood pressure in the first place is 22% lower in people with the highest vitamin C intake compared with those with the lowest. One study found that people who took more than 700 milligrams a day of supplemental vitamin C had a 25% lower chance of developing coronary heart disease, the precursor of heart attacks. Studies of vitamin C administration directly into the veins or arteries in human volunteers and with people with arterial disease reveal a powerful effect on endothelial function, demonstrating immediate and significant improvements in blood flow and blood pressure. And as studies of oral vitamin C supplementation at doses 1,000 milligrams a day provide evidence of reduced oxidative damage to the LDL cholesterol and diabetes, a group at very high risk of cardiovascular complications. A study of older adults published in late 2012 showed a substantial, significant improvement in endothelial function following an oral dose of 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C coupled with vitamin E and alpha-lipoic acid. Since it is difficult to maintain all-day optimum vitamin C blood levels, boosting the body's absorption of vitamin C and reducing its degradation is important. Now, when you take quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N, and half the amount of vitamin C, you can sustain your vitamin C level, and it works synergistically much better. But I do believe, unlike the article, that you can maintain optimal levels of vitamin C by taking vitamin C before you work out in the morning, after you work out, mid-morning, before lunch, mid-afternoon, early evening, and before you go to bed at night. It can make an enormous difference. It also is going to help you. Because it was interesting, because the woman then She says, look at your hair. I said, yeah, look at my hair. So what about my hair? She says, how does it stay so rich looking? I said, well, I use the right shampoos and conditioners. I clean my scalp. I do deep massage each night on myself. And I use different oils about 3 days a week, coconut oil, an olive oil. They all have enormous benefit to the scalp, the tissue, and the hair. And also, that's external. But internal, it depends upon the percentages of your diet that are composed of raw living nutrients, including the green juices and the red juices or their counterparts in powders. The more you have, the healthier skin, the healthier immune system, the healthier your hair, and the more likely you are. And she said, didn't you once say that you could exceed different limits? And what did you call that? I said, that's called the laws of compensation, which mean this. Any time in life that you have an imbalance, anywhere in your life, let's say it's genetic or trauma, injury, viral, bacterial, fungal, parasitic, environmental, chemical toxicity like lead, cadmium, mercury, aluminum, the gene responds either in an on or off position to the epigenetics of the environment that it's in. Hence, positive environment, healing diet, turn the gene on. Therefore, the opposite is always true. You cannot have half of a truth and subscribe to a universal reality. Meaning, I cannot say there is good without also acknowledging there is evil. Happy, there's sad. Positive, there's negative. Kind, there's unkind. Selfless, there's selfish. And we are always present with all those manifestations. It's just that we don't always embrace them. And you are what you embrace. You are the energy that you take on. Irrespective of the facade, the game, the charade that we put to the public to maintain our acceptance or responsibility or respectability. You can have very functional people at work and very dysfunctional at home. So, if you choose to eat an unhealthy diet, that choice is a conditional choice. Conditional. And that will not deceive the cells. That is a negative energy. If you choose to accept a healthier alternative, you turn the genes into a healthier state of on. Hence, you change the epigenetics. You're synchronizing and harmonizing positive energy, the food, the way it's prepared, the way you eat it, with the ultimate outcome. You become what you eat, and you drink, and you breathe, and you think. But you must exceed the level of the genetic expression, the cellular expression, in order to reverse it. In effect, you have to exceed by several measures the problem before you manifest a solution. Hence, when I started to exceed having one glass of juice a day, which I had, I never smoked or drank or had drugs, and I was able then to create a new energy to the cells, because I have male pattern baldness, as all the men in my family do. They're all bald. And I was going bald, even though I had a perfect diet. But even though it was a perfect diet, the energy vibration was not intense and it was not great enough to exceed the genetic predisposition. Therefore, the reason that my hair looks the way it does, and if you're looking in the camera right now, take a look. I'm pulling my hair back. This is all new hair growth in the front. If you're looking right now, and this is a high-definition camera with lots of light, you'll see as I pull it back, all this is new hair growth. And this is how my hair grows. It grows fast and long and healthy. Well, in the same way with the nails. Nails are clear, pink, hard. That's the way nails should be. Not speckled, cracked, chipped, and thin and discolored. Because all that's manifesting your biochemistry. So, by eating the right foods in the right concentrations, underline concentrations, by providing the excess energy above what we would normally take in, and the energy is positive, you can create a new genetic expression. Now, because of going back to this rule that you cannot have half of a truth without acknowledging the other half, then if it works on hair, why can't it work on skin? Well, the skin and your skin and many other people's skin shows that as you age, your skin doesn't have to drag, sag, be pocked, jowy, crow's feet, unless you didn't exceed the way that skin is normally produced. If you do exceed that limitation in a healthy way with the collagen correction in a new collagen, then you actually tighten the skin again. And hence, with the new tightened skin, you'll have more of the subcutaneous tissue. You'll have a softer appearance. And hence, you simply won't look your age. But if you're doing this externally on the skin, you are also simultaneously doing it to all of your organs and muscles. By doing the right thing in one area, it is already doing the right thing in all areas. A healthy nutrient that goes through the body about every 6.5 minutes to every area, every cell, is every cell is nurtured. So you're nurturing all the body, you know, and that's what's important. So when it comes to vitamin C, if there's only one nutrient you can afford to take, make sure you take it. And take it throughout the day. All right? It can make a difference. And with cancer, cancer results from a mutation of genes that regulate cellular proliferation. And some of this DNA gene damage is caused by excessive oxidation. And some studies suggest that 1 in 12 cancers might be prevented by assuring higher levels of antioxidant intake. And the best evidence for supplementing as a cancer preventative is found in cancers of the digestive tract. Vitamin C can prevent stomach colonization with the bacterium H. pylori, a major cause of stomach and small intestinal cancers. And it does so in part by blocking an oxidant-induced enzyme the organism needs in order to set up shop in the stomach lining. And studies of supplementation with vitamin C in combination with other antioxidant vitamins and minerals shows that, for example, you can prevent the reoccurrence of intestinal polyps, adenomas, and the precursors of serious colorectal cancers. And similar findings have now been reported on esophageal cancer as well. And there's now evidence of a vitamin C protective effect in endothelial and lab studies of breast cancer. So those are some of the things that vitamin C can do. Lung disease is also important. It can help you there as well, and in diabetes. But I'm not going to call it diabetes anymore. I'm going to call it diabesity, because that's what it is. Obesity and diabetes, the two are interlinked. And immune dysfunction. Vitamin C has been the subject of endless discussion on the common cold. Well, the strong evidence now supports that a dose of about 1,000 milligrams a day taken regularly can shorten the duration of a cold. But I believe at 6,000 milligrams a day, you can help prevent a cold. And cells in the immune system fight infections in part by destroying invading organisms with burst of oxidative activity that puts adjuvant healthy tissue at risk. Supplementing with bioavailable vitamin C protects normal host tissue, allowing infecting organisms to be destroyed without collateral damage. And these immune-boosting functions have a clear effect on another major health concern, stomach infection. I just mentioned Helicobacter pylori, a major cause of gastritis and stomach cancer. Studies show that following eradication of the organism by antibiotics, sustained daily vitamin C of 1,000 milligrams reduced the severity of stomach irritation and inflammation. But lung disease, it also works. And with osteoporosis, bones require a strong matrix of collagen proteins in order to develop and maintain their structural integrity and proper mineralization. And vitamin C is the essential collagen production nutrient. And the less vitamin C, the poorer the bone health, the greater the bone loss. So you need vitamin C to reduce the rate of bone reabsorption, the principal cause of osteoporosis. I'm suggesting 3,000 milligrams a day. That's the latest. A little longer on Classroom on the Air, but at least you get more insight. Now to a break. We're going to come back. I'm going to give you the latest on... I'm going to give you the one on aluminum now, and then we'll come back. I'll give you the latest on the environment, a commentary. I want you to hear a little outtake from someone, and then my guest. From the London Times, an article entitled A Well-Planned Retirement. Think of this. This is a true story. Outside of England, Bristol Zoo, there is a parking lot for 150 cars and 8 buses. For 25 years, its parking fees were managed by a very pleasant attendant. The fees for cars, $1.40, for buses, about $7. Then one day, after 25 solid years of never missing a day of work, 7 days a week, he just didn't show up. So the zoo management called the city council and asked it to send them another parking agent. The council did some research and replied that the parking lot was the zoo's own responsibility. The zoo advised the council that the attendant was a city employee. The city council responded that the lot attendant had never been on the city payroll. Meanwhile, sitting in his villa somewhere on the coast of Spain or France or Italy is a man who apparently had a ticket booth installed completely on his own and then has simply begun to show up every day, commencing to collect and keep the parking fees, estimated at about $560 a day for 25 years, assuming 7 days a week. That's $7 million. And no one even knows his name. Well, how about that? Well, there's a proprietor. Now, to the issue of aluminum in vaccines as a principal cause of neurological problems. This is from Gaia Health. Quote, a newly published research by Keio Conference scientists show that aluminum adjuvant in vaccines transfers to the brain. They have documented the path from injection site to the brain, and that once in the brain, it persists. Newborns, the elderly, and people with a certain genetic variation are particularly at risk. This study adds a major link to the association of aluminum adjuvants in vaccines with neurological disorders. It demonstrates the pathway along which aluminum in vaccine adjuvants is transferred from the injection site to the brain. They have also identified a likely carrier and a means by which the process occurs. The study is exhaustive, eliminating a wide array of options that might mitigate against their findings. They also focused on two groups to determine if their findings indicate that they are a particular risk. These include newborns and people with certain genetic variant. On top of that, the elderly may be at significantly high risk for aluminum adjuvants induced neurological harm. Well, now just imagine how many vaccines had both aluminum and mercury, because they serve different purposes. So even when they took the mercury out of many vaccines, they didn't take the aluminum out, and hence the association with autism and other neurological problems. On the environmental segment, this is from Joe Rahm, Think Progress. Quote, the Antarctic, and this is from a scientist, the Antarctic Peninsula has warmed to a level where even small increases in temperature can now lead to a big increase in summer ice melt. The new findings quote a nearly 1,000% increase in melt intensity on the Antarctic Peninsula in the last few hundred years. But here's the most worrisome news from this 1,000-year reconstruction of the ice melt intensity and mean temperature. Now, this is published in the major journal Nature Geoscience. Quote, The warming has occurred in progressive phases since AD 1460, but intensification of melt is non-linear and has largely occurred since the mid-20th century. Summer melting is now at a level that is unprecedented over the last 1,000 years. We conclude that ice on the Antarctic Peninsula is now particularly susceptible to rapid increases in melting and loss in response to relatively small increases in mean temperature. End quote. In short, while some mistakenly assert that climate is less sensitive than we thought, the fact is that polar ice loss is accelerating far beyond what the models had projected even a few years ago, and the whole region appears more sensitive than previously thought. In fact, just in 2006, Penn State climatologist Richard Ailey explained that observation had indicated the great ice sheets appearing to shrinking, quote, 100 years ahead of schedule. And NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory reported in 2011 that polar ice sheets mass loss is speeding up on pace 1 foot of sea level rise in the next 25 years. What's happening at the South Pole, which has 90% of the world's ice? Well, we learned that Antarctica's Pine Island Glacier has been thinning 4 times faster than it was 10 years ago. Quote, nothing in the natural world is lost at an accelerated exponential rate like this glacier, said Nature magazine. Quote, dynamic thinning of Greenland and Antarctica sheet ice ocean's margins is more sensitive, pervasive, and enduring, and important than previously realized. Let me go back. Why is this happening, and why should we be concerned? Quote, listen to this. We know, this is from the Science magazine, we know deep ocean heat is rapidly melting Antarctic ice. And we know these warm ocean currents melting Antarctica are so intense that seawater appears to boil on the surface like a kettle on a stove. Last April, researchers in Nature magazine stated that melting from below, quote, may already have triggered a period of unstable glacier retreat. West Antarctica is warming 300% faster than global average. And the key point is that West Antarctic ice sheet is inherently far less stable than Greenland because it's underwater, substantially underwater. In fact, it's deep underwater, and therefore it's melting from underneath. Quote, flow into the bedrock is hundreds of meters deeper than the previous estimates, providing exit routes for ice from further inland if ice sheet collapse is underway. The warmer it gets, the more unstable the outlet glaciers will become. Now, you go back to what they said in the beginning, and this is the key word, and this I've been saying constantly. And it says, quote, is nonlinear. Now, what does that mean in lay language? It means that no one can any longer accurately predict with a mathematical model because those have to be linear. This is nonlinear. That means that we could see a massive break in ice sheet and falling into the ocean. We could see so much water pouring in over a short period of time that we would be unprepared for all the people living at the sea level. That is the outcome of that. And finally, in our environmental segment today, according to a team of scientists, environmental scientists from the World Health Organization, and Sri Lanka, scientists have linked, quote, the high prevalence of chronic kidney disease of uncertain etiology on the island to indiscriminate use of agricultural fertilizers and pesticides. In its final report on February 28th, the team led by World Health Organization researcher Shanthi Mendes identified that 450,000 individuals were suffering from chronic kidney disease due to the application in the area of these pesticides. So we have to be aware there is a consequence in using the big agri's chemicals. There's a consequence in human health, animal health, and environmental health. And we should not deceive ourselves into thinking otherwise. Before we go to my guest for a newsmaker update, Dr. Elizabeth Satoris, who's in Mallorca, Spain, we have to look for a moment at the public's transportation system that we never discuss. The deterioration of the nation's public transportation, like the deterioration of healthcare, education, social services, public utilities, bridges, and roads, is part of the relentless seizing and harvesting of public resources and programs by corporations. These corporations are steadily stripping the American infrastructure. Public sector unions are being broken. Wages and benefits are being slashed. Workers are forced to put in longer hours in unsafe workplaces, often jeopardizing public safety. The communities that need public services most are losing them. And where public service is continued, it is reduced or substandard and costlier. Only the security and surveillance network and the military are permitted to function with efficiency in their role as the guardians of corporate power. We now resemble the developing world. We have small pockets of obscene wealth, ailing infrastructure, and public service, huge swaths of grinding poverty, and militarized police and internal security. The assault on public transportation, which has devastating consequences for the poor who cannot get to work or the doctor's office without it, is not new. General Motors, Standard Oil, Firestone Tire and Rubber, B.F. Phillips Petroleum and Mack Manufacturing set up companies in the 1930s. First, United Cities Motor Transit, and later National City Lines, in order to rip up the city trolley tracks and replace them with bus and car routes. These corporations, joined by companies such as Greyhound, pushed through the national highway grid. City bus companies, as riders turned to cars, began to go bankrupt. The federal government in 1964 approved the Urban Mass Transit Act, which provided capital and operating funds for mass transit to keep it on life support. The corporations, meanwhile, pushed through huge urban renewal plans, all funded by the taxpayer, which focused exclusively on highways, tunnels, and bridges and further sidelined public transportation. Jane Jacobs, who wrote the 1961 book The Death and Life of the Great American Cities, presently understood and fought these corporate forces, led in New York City by Robert Moses, who forcibly displaced hundreds of thousands of residents and demolished neighborhoods to cater to the demands of the car and the fossil fuel industries. Robert Caro, in his biography of Moses, the power broker, exposed this relentless process in depressing detail. This process of destroying our public transportation system is largely complete. Our bus and rail system, compared to Europe's or Japan's, is a joke. But even more insidious process has begun. Multinational corporations, many of them foreign, are slowly consolidating transportation systems into a few private hands. Of the top three multinationals that control transportation in the United States, only one, MV Transportation, is based here. First Group, a multi-billion-dollar corporation headquartered in the United Kingdom and a product of Margaret Thatcher's privatization of British Mass Transit, now owns First Student, which operates 54,000 school buses in 38 states and 9 Canadian provinces and has 6 million student riders. First Group also has a controlling stake in Greyhound and Veolia Transportation, a subsidiary of Transdev, a conglomerate headquartered in France. Has 150 contracts to run mass transit systems in the United States. It was Veolia, after Hurricane Katrina, that took over the New Orleans bus system. And it did what it has done elsewhere. It stripped bus workers of their pensions. New York's Nassau County Bus Service, once part of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, has turned over to Veolia after the French corporation hired former three-term Senator Aldamato of New York as its lobbyist. Veolia, which when it takes over a U.S. property as in New Orleans or in Nassau County refuses to give workers a defined benefit plan, is partly owned by a pension fund that covers one-third of French citizens. U.S. workers are losing their benefit plans to a company created to provide benefit plans for the French. Veolia is currently lobbying Rhode Island and Atlanta to privatize their bus services. Quote, our money is meaningless in politics, Larry Hanley, an international president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, lamented when we met in his office here in Washington. It is still sought after. Well, the battles in towns and cities across the country usually pit 100 or 200 beleaguered union workers in a local bus system against a powerful multinational and its lobbyists and firms such as Patton Boggs, former Senator Trent Lott of Mississippi, and Rodney Slater, a Secretary of Transportation under Bill Clinton, worked for these multinational transportation firms as Patton Boggs' lobbyists. Armed with buckets of corporate cash, Lott and Slater lobbied the Senate last year to insert a call for privatization into a highway bill on behalf of the multinational corporations. The provision, which was inserted without hearings, without the public debate, without documented evidence, or without prior approval by either the House or the Senate, mandates the federal government to undertake feasibility studies to privatize our entire nation's mass transit on behalf of the French, British, and American transportation corporations. This gives the local governments political cover to privatize. And that is the issue. The $5.8 billion stimulus package for public transportation, largely because of Larry Summers' insistence, did not provide any money to fund operating costs for public transportation. This meant that city public bus services must operate on declining local tax revenue, could do little more than with the stimulus money than work on infrastructure. Engineering firms in the construction industry, including construction trade unions, aggressively lobby for federal dollars and transit, but they make sure the money goes to real estate developers or corporations that build bridges and tunnels rather than expand service, pay operating costs, or cut fares. The nation's senior transit officials often leave office to lobby for these same real estate developers and construction firms. When Christopher Boylan, who was the deputy executive director of the New York State Metropolitan Transportation Authority, the nation's largest transit system, retired in 2010, he went to work as a lobbyist for the General Contractors Association of America. The wreckage of the nation's public transportation system is staggering. Greyhound, before government deregulations in the 1980s, had 20,000 unionized members. It now has 2,500. The company before regulation, along with Trailways, ran a nationwide bus network that provided public transportation to towns and remote corners of the country. But once the bus industry was deregulated, companies such as Greyhound and Trailways were no longer required to serve remote or poor areas. Pensions and wages, especially as new non-unionized bus companies arose, were reduced. Greyhound bus drivers, once the highest paid in the country in the 1970s, their yearly pay was more than $100,000, adjusted for inflation, now make $40,000. And the company has eliminated perhaps as much as 80% of its foreign nationwide services. Many bus drivers no longer work full-time, and a loophole in the federal law exempts inner-city bus drivers from Fair Labor Standards Act overtime provisions. So that's what we have, and that's why we're in trouble. Chris Hedges, I'm Gary Knoll, now my guest. Nice to have you with us today, Elizabeth.
Hi, Gary, and good to be with you again.
I'm interested in the discussion that you could have with us as a newsmaker update on corporate dominance. In the late 1990s, there was the emergence of civil society to speak out against globalization and the multilateral institutions and their corporate allies who wanted to put the planet on a golden straitjacket. That's what Thomas Friedman wrote, and although he saw this as a great thing, I didn't. But what was important at that time was the emergence of civil society. The Cold War ended, and it was being seen that the nation-state lost much of its high position in national and global governance, and the new landscape up till 9/11 was a broader playing field between government, the international multilateral institutions like the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, the UN, then the multinational corporations, and finally civil society, each trying to define the role of governance for the future in their own interest. Now, you are an expert on globalization, past and present, so I'd like to hear your analysis of who is controlling what today in the world, and how can the voices of environmental and social sanity be better heard?
Well, Gary, I can give you an example from what you were just talking about. I didn't even know that Veolia, the French company, had gotten its tendrils into the U.S. public transportation system, that they were privatizing that and everything you've just talked about. Here in Europe, Veolia and one other French company control most of the water of Europe. They've privatized the water. If anything should not be privatized, that's it's almost more basic even than food. And, of course, we're hearing about all of the horrors of Monsanto. I'm sure you've talked about them on your show, what's going on there right now. And anyway, Paris, I'd like people to know, is the first big city to have taken back its water rights from a company like Veolia. And of course, as an evolution biologist, I always think in terms of how nature does things, and nature abhors monocultures. So even for that reason alone, it's very dangerous for these huge corporations to now be more powerful than governments. I guess you know that 51% of the largest organizations in the world now are not governments, but corporations. So this trend toward monoculturing everything and controlling everything is just very, very dangerous. It makes it almost impossible for nature to do what nature does so well, which is to balance, and you used the words synchronizing and harmonizing our bodies from what you eat. Well, that's nature's always synchronizing and harmonizing ecosystems and making sure, like a mother, that you take a little here, you give a little there, and everybody comes out all right, whereas our corporate takeovers globally have meant that everyone doesn't do well at all, and that you get this, you know, 1 to 99% stuff going on. So I don't need to tell you about the dangers of this. And well, the good news is that people are localizing their economies, and that's so important, because it's clear that governments are helpless in the grip of the corporations to be able to take care of people, and people are learning that we're going to have to take care of ourselves. And the other good news is that takeover system is unsustainable, and unsustainable means cannot last. So the quicker we take things into our own hands and form our own living economies locally, the better off we'll be when the big collapse comes.
I appreciate that insight. And by the way, Dr. Elizabeth Satouris, that is A-S-A-H-T-O-U-R-I-S, and her website is satouris.com. She is starting a new program on the Progressive Radio Network on Friday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, called The Oracle of Mallorca, and which is off the coast of Spain. And we look forward to this. What are you going to be talking about?
Well, I'm excited, Gary. This is kind of real fun. I mean, you know that I'm a deep pastist as an evolution biologist, and I became a deep pastist in order to be a good futurist. I'm very passionate about a better human future, and I've always, all my life, I've been working on who are we humans, where do we come from, where are we headed now. And then a dear friend of mine recently told me, as I was pondering my future, he said, "I see you as the Oracle of Mallorca." And as you just said, you know, Mallorca is where I live. It's a very beautiful island off the Mediterranean coast of Spain, and I'm working on sustainability here. It's an island in the Mid-Earth Sea. The Mediterranean is the Mid-Earth, and that's where oracles first appeared in ancient Greece. So I kind of like the sound of the Oracle of Mallorca. And when you asked me, Gary, to host a show on this network, I thought I might as well launch that new career right here as my own program. Well, so ancient oracles, as you know, generally talked in riddles, maybe to give them some leeway to weasel out of predictions being taken too literally. But I see this time in our human history as one in which we're facing entirely too many hidden meanings and other unclarities. So I intend to be as clear as possible while always urging my listeners to think for yourselves. And so this oracle will ask questions as well as answering questions. And I'm going to launch this Friday's program by talking about bacteria, just because they're my very favorite creatures in Earth's evolution, the only ones that were here from the very beginning as Earth's first creatures, and may very well be our last, and are so much with us that as you'll hear if you tune in on Friday, our bodies are practically made of them. And that's why I'm calling Friday's program Bacteria Are Us.
Good. Well, we're looking forward to it. Thank you very much for being with us for this short conversation with Remarkable Mind, Dr. Elizabeth Satouris. I'm Gary Knoll. Now, we're going to close out today's program with, and I'm going to thank Bibich from Miss Bibich from Florida for sending this. This is a young man, 10 years of age, who decided to speak out about genetically engineering. And so we look for our scientists, we look for the great environmentalists, we never look at our youngest population to have these insights and this determination and this common sense. Well, this is what one young person had to say at a recent discussion on GMOs.
Hello, my name is Burke Bear, and I'm 11 years old. I came here today to talk about what's wrong with our food system. First of all, I would like to say that I'm really amazed at how easily kids are led to believe all the marketing and advertising on TV, at public schools, and pretty much everywhere else you look. It seems to me like corporations are always trying to get kids, like me, to get their parents to buy stuff that really isn't good for us or the planet. Little kids especially are attracted by colorful packaging and plastic toys. I must admit, I used to be one of them. I also used to think that all of our food came from these happy little farms where pigs rolled in mud and cows grazed on grass all day. What I discovered was this is not true. I began to look into this stuff on the internet, in books, and in documentary films, in my travels with my family. I discovered the dark side of the industrialized food system. First, there's genetically engineered seeds and organisms. That is when a seed is manipulated in a laboratory to do something not intended by nature, like taking the DNA of a fish and putting it into the DNA of a tomato. Yuck. Don't get me wrong. I like fish and tomatoes, but this is just creepy. The seeds are then planted, then grown. The food they produce has been proven to cause cancer and other problems in lab animals. And people have been eating food produced this way since the 1990s, and most folks don't even know they exist. Did you know rats fed genetically engineered corn had developed signs of liver and kidney toxicity? These include kidney inflammation and lesions and decreased kidney weight. Yet almost all the corn we eat has been altered genetically in some way. And let me tell you, corn isn't everything. And don't even get me started on the confined animal feeding operations called CAFOs. Conventional farmers use chemical fertilizers made from fossil fuels that they mix with the dirt to make plants grow. They do this because they've stripped the soil from all nutrients from growing the same crop over and over again. Next, more harmful chemicals are sprayed on fruits and vegetables, like pesticides and herbicides, to kill weeds and bugs. When it rains, these chemicals seep into the ground or run off into our waterways, poisoning our water too. Then they irradiate our food, trying to make it last longer, so it can travel thousands of miles from where it's grown to the supermarkets. So I ask myself, how can I change? How can I change these things? This is what I found out. I discovered that there's a movement for a better way. Now, a while back, I wanted to be an NFL football player. I decided that I'd rather be an organic farmer instead. Thank you. And that way, I can have a greater impact on the world. I learned about this guy named Joel Salatin. They call him a lunatic farmer because he grows against the system. Since I'm homeschooled, I want to go hear him speak one day. This man, this lunatic farmer, doesn't use any pesticides, herbicides, or genetically modified seeds. And so for that, he's called crazy by the system. I want you to know that we can all make a difference by making different choices, by buying our food directly from local farmers or neighbors who we know in real life. Some people say organic or local food is more expensive, but is it really? With all these things I've been learning about the food system, it seems to me that we can either pay the farmer or we can pay the hospital. I know. Now, I know definitely which one I would choose. I want you to know that there are farms out there, like Bill Keener and Sequatchie Coast Farms in Tennessee, whose cows do eat grass and whose pigs do roll in the mud, just like I thought. Sometimes I go to Bill's farm and volunteer so I can see up close and personal where the meat I eat comes from. I want you to know that I believe kids will eat fresh vegetables and good food if they know more about it and where it really comes from. I want you to know that there are farmers markets in every community popping up. I want you to know that me and my brother and sister actually like eating baked kale chips. I try to share this everywhere I go. Not too long ago, my uncle said that he offered my 6-year-old cousin cereal. He asked if he wanted organic toasted O's or the sugar-coated flakes. You know, the one with the big striped cartoon carrots on the front? my little cousin told his dad that he would rather have the organic toasted O cereal because Burke said he shouldn't eat sparkly cereal. And that, my friends, is how we can make a difference, one kid at a time. So next time you're at the grocery store, think local. Choose organic, know your farm, and know your food. Thank you.
Well, imagine if 20 million young people had the same insights. We'd be a different country. We're out of time. Tomorrow, Rupert Sheldrake, continuing with a conversation with a remarkable mind for the entire program. He is quite simply going to dispel the scientific dogmas that are really delusions, give you an entirely different understanding, morphic resonance, and applicable in parapsychological research. It's going to be one wonderful program tomorrow. I'll let people know about it. Thank you very much for listening. Now, a few moments of talk back, 888-874-4888. Luann Panessi's on. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. That was something else.
Yeah.
From one little girl.
One little boy.
Like one of, oh, that was a boy?
That was a little 11-year-old boy.
Wow. Talk about dynamic energies at that age.
Yeah, and he was doing it without notes. This was all off the top of his head.
That's wonderful. Well, that's the dynamic energy for sure.
Yes.
Well, I've got an article here. Are you ready for this? Men have been kicked out of the festival, out of a festival in Saudi Arabia for being too handsome. So, Gary, don't make plans to go to any festivals. I'm not. Not in Saudi Arabia. Yep. In Saudi Arabia, three men were ejected from the annual Jenadriva Heritage and Cultural Festival for being too handsome. An official from the festival said the three men, who happened to be delegates from the United Arab Emirates, were taken out on the grounds. They're too handsome, and that the commission members feared female visitors could fall for them. As you have most likely heard once or twice before, Saudi Arabia is an incredibly conservative Sunni Muslim society that prevents women from even so much as interacting with males they're not related to. So in this situation, you can see why festival management would take extreme caution by deporting the three men to Abu Dhabi.
Jesus.
You cannot make this stuff up.
No, you can't. Well, I appreciate the insight. Thank you, Luann. Let's
okay.
go over. Let's go over and say. By the way, next week I was speaking with my daughter this morning, as she was making some absolutely delicious desserts, and we're going to have her on next Monday or Tuesday to talk about inviting some people, just as a public service, who would like to learn gluten-free, sugar-free, healthy baking into the kitchen next week. So they'll. Come at you next week. Let's say hello to Utrice. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we are doing media literacy, and we're using the events of the Boston Marathon to illustrate the point that all that's news isn't necessarily all that's news.
Great. We look forward to it because there's too much speculation. We have to have more facts and know how to decide what is a fact from what is propaganda or supposition. Utrice Lead, coming in just a moment. Please stay with us.